Welcome to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. I'm Michelle Boyce.
And I'm Gio Lakey.
And we have a great show for you today. We are covering the hate crimes that happened to Eric, who's in studio, last September. And the judgment just came down in that, and the community is not happy. And we also have Dan Pugh with us, who is the chair of the HBT Working Group. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Hi, Eric.
Hi there.
And so,
well, I must say I'm very glad that you have your voice back.
Yeah, last week was pretty miserable for a girl that makes her living talking to have absolutely no voice. So if I start sounding like a truck driver, my apologies. So back in September, Eric, and let's talk to you first because, well, it's all about you.
It's all about me, just like it was last year on September 27th. That was my birthday, and that was the night of the attack.
And walk us through that night.
Well, I was walking home with my, at the time, boyfriend after leaving the bar, celebrating my birthday just like everybody else. We were holding hands, walking down Central, which my assumption was the safe part of London. And we went around these two guys, and after getting quite some distance from them, we heard some remarks that were made at us for the fact that we were holding hands. Just ignored it because I was so close to home already, figured we'd just, you know, walk a little faster, not that far away, and had gotten hit from behind and then attacked from the front, and it just had happened so quickly. I was on my feet 1 minute, and the next minute I was on the ground, and then not even 20 seconds later, there was a London police cruiser, so.
Wonderful. And now, how drunk was the person that attacked you, since that has become a major contentious issue?
According to the case, very inebriated to the point of lack of memory.
Ah, okay. Yes, and was that your experience?
Oh, I believe so, too. It would have had to have been. I mean, I can't think of nothing else to justify it.
Okay. So then the press got a hold of your story.
Yes.
And it was all over the news and everything else. And then we had a rally in Victoria Park called the Rally for Peaceful Communities. And that was on October 7th. And at that rally, the mayor of London, Anne-Marie DeCicco-Best, and the deputy chief of police, Brad Duncan, and the diversity officer for the London Police Department made a whole bunch of promises to the city, and we have that tape for you now.
Those that come into our city, you are welcome. Please, please respect our values. Please, please come into our city and enjoy the businesses that we have to offer, the educational facilities, the best in the world, our hospitals, our parks, our tourism, our city. We have a lot to offer. But if you don't respect our values, we will send you home. First up on our list, we have the Honorable Mayor, Anne DeCicco-Best. Please give her a warm welcome.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I have two of my colleagues that are also here, Councillors Roger Crancy and Steve Orser, if maybe you want to acknowledge them as well. And members of the police service I'll introduce in just a moment. I appreciate the invitation to be here today, and I am, of course, as your mayor here, but also as a member of the Police Services Board for the past 13 years. And maybe more importantly than that, I'm a Londoner, and I've grown up in the city and have seen a lot of changes. And when I first decided that I was going to run for council, and certainly in my years as your mayor, I've always believed that this is the kind of community where we focused on issues like job diversity, making sure people could live a great life, having strong neighborhoods, making sure that, as Michelle said, that we had great health care and education and all the things that make a city the best that it can possibly be. And part of that is to be a safe city. And I don't want my London or your London to be a place where someone is walking down the street and needs to look over their shoulder. I don't want our London to be a place where people are afraid to be in their neighborhood or in a place of business. The acts of violence that we've seen in particular over the last couple of weeks, but I would say at any time, are reprehensible, they are appalling, and they are unacceptable. And they are not the kinds of things that if we continue to work as a community that we can't stop, because I think that we can. It's been our commitment and our mandate as a police service to work with our community and our council, but I think it's broader than that, to work with the community at large in making sure that we understand that we all have a role to play if we want London to be the best and the safest city anywhere. That's the commitment that I made a long time ago. It's the commitment that I want to reiterate again here today. I think that it's all of us that have to continue to be vigilant on these issues, to continue to work with the police, and to continue to work with each other. And I'm sure that if we do that, there will be a day where we will stamp out this type of violence against anyone, anyone in our community that can walk the streets and know that they don't have to look behind them. So thank you very much for inviting me to be here. The Deputy Chief, Brad Duncan, wants to say a few words, and then we also have our Diversity Officer that wants to say a few words.
Good evening, and thank you for the opportunity to attend and address the Peaceful Communities Rally. As the Mayor has indicated, the London Police Service is committed to providing a safe and secure community for all our citizens. A community that is supportive of everyone regardless of race, ethnicity, cultural background, or sexual orientation. As Deputy Chief of Operations for the London Police Service, one of my primary duties is to ensure that we have safe streets. Streets where individuals and couples can walk freely, free from harassment and violence, free to work, live, and play in our city. We will not tolerate violence in any form perpetrated against those who have done nothing wrong and are targeted by those who prey on someone simply because of who they are. We have all the fundamental rights to enjoy this wonderful city freely and without fear or concerns. I commit to you that anyone who becomes a victim of violence will be treated with compassion and understanding. We will investigate and charge persons who engage in hate crimes, ensuring that our victims are protected and the offender is brought before the courts. In London, we investigate over 30 hate crimes each year. And of those investigations, 30% involve members of our LGBT communities. We also realize that in a number of jurisdictions, self-reported statistics collected outside of regular official crime statistics indicate that many of the victims from our LGBT communities are afraid to report incidents to the police as they fear further discrimination and harassment from the community. They fear that the disclosure of their sexual orientation or gender identity will be exposed by investigators, which would further complicate an already difficult and confusing situation. I'm here to tell you this evening that you will need not fear this form of response from the London Police Service. We are an organization that is sensitive to victims' needs, and the men and women who patrol our streets are understanding and compassionate, and will investigate each and every act of violence towards all members of our community. But I must emphasize that victims need to report incidents to police. You need to provide us with the information that will allow us to investigate incidents, arrest suspects, and lay charges. In this way, we can clearly denounce such behavior while at the same time sending a clear message that those who commit hate crimes will be dealt with in accordance with the law. This rally is all about awareness and acknowledging that we are a community that celebrates our diversity, a community where each of us contributes to making London a vibrant city. We will not tolerate anyone who would challenge our collective spirit by preying upon those who may be reluctant to report abusive, violent, and hate-motivated acts. If your voice is to be heard beyond tonight, I urge you to seek assistance from your police service should you encounter hate-based behavior or violence. Tonight I'm joined, as our mayor indicated, by our diversity officer, Constable Marcel Marcellin, who I am sure is well known to many of you, for he sits on many committees. Marcel is a key person in our organization whose primary responsibility is to reach out to our many diverse communities to provide an understanding of what the police can do for you and to promote an immediate response to incidents requiring police intervention. We are your police service. We are committed to the protection of our citizens, and we encourage a collective and collaborative approach to ending any form of discrimination which can lead to the commission of hate crimes. I thank all of you for attending, and the organizers, Michelle and others. I thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to all of you here this evening. I would now like to call upon Marcel to share with you some of the initiatives that we are undertaking as your police service. Marcel?
Thank you. As you've already heard, I'm Marcel Marsland, Diversity Officer of the London Police Service. And I've had the opportunity to meet with members of the LGBT community here in London and in other jurisdictions. My message to you tonight is not only are we listening, we're doing something. We've embarked on an education and awareness campaign with our community partners, specifically the HBT Working Group. We plan to host a hate crime community conference at our police headquarters where we can discuss solutions to the problem of underreporting homophobic, biphobic, and transphobic hate crimes. We're also in the process of producing a variety of outreach materials in the form of pamphlets and brochures designed to raise awareness of the issue. We plan to strengthen the connections that are already existing in our community, such as emergency helplines, victim services, and support groups. And finally, we plan to host a presentation at our police headquarters on RHBP, which is a successful anti-hate campaign that's being used in another jurisdiction at this time. RHBP stands for Report Homophobic Violence, period. I believe if we can come together as a community and deal with these issues, we'll be successful. And this rally is evidence of that. I look forward to working with you to ensure that our community is safe. Thank you.
So that gives everybody a history, and that was on October the 7th. We're now on March 15th, and, you know, the issues that were there at that point in time, I mean, all you and your boyfriend did was hold hands walking down the streets.
Yep.
You never name-called to these individuals. You never engaged them in any way.
No, those actions were in no way instigated in any way, shape, or form. Even after those remarks were made, I did not retaliate those marks.
Exactly. And, I mean, what if you were brothers or father and son? I mean, that's what always gets me about these issues, you know? My ex-husband was 15 years older than me, and, you know, people occasionally... He looked old, I looked young, and people, mistook us for father and son. And, you know, so what happens when, you know, a father and a son are holding hands like that, and somebody comes at them with homophobic violence? I mean, this just isn't a gay, lesbian, bi, trans issue. This is, and that's why the rally was called a rally for peaceful communities, because these issues, although... You've identified yourself as a gay male with a partner. These issues do not only affect us. You know? Mm-hmm. What do you think about that, Dan?
Yeah, no, it's a good point, Michelle. And I find that oftentimes when we're doing this kind of advocacy work and when we're going out in community and doing, trainings around anti-homophobia and, you know, raising awareness about heterosexism and oppression and all that type of thing, that... I think a lot of times people mistake homophobia in and of itself as being something strictly related to members of the LGBT community, and not necessarily an issue for anyone else. And that's not the case. And the point that you bring up is quite valid in that anyone could be a victim of, you know, homophobic hate, regardless of sexual orientation. You know, when we go out and do these types of presentations, we have examples of that all the time. And it's not, It's not an issue that particularly targets just gay people. Anyone, regardless of orientation, can be affected by it.
That's true. I believe at the time that the rally was being held, there was also an article in a student newspaper and a subsequent blog that followed up in which a straight man had mentioned that he was receiving the effects of the homophobic comics and the confrontations while walking home from the bars just because he was well-groomed, well-dressed, and perceived to be.
Yeah. It's not just the homophobia either. I mean, at the time of the rally as well, the London Free Press published the article about the Muslim woman who was attacked in the elevator on Mornington Avenue.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Any one particular individual that violates any kind of scripted gender role or gender code or sexual identity is victim to some kind of discrimination. And that happens in that example. You know, people, even straight men who have a tendency to fall into that whole quote-unquote metrosexual identity, which I think is just ridiculous. It's just like this notion that we have to come up with something that captures somebody who strays from, you know, falling into being interested in playing football and drinking beer and hanging out with his buds and that type of thing. Like, if he's interested in getting his hair done and looking good or having some kind of an interest in self-appearance, we've got to come up with this metrosexual identity. And he's also a victim or susceptible to some kind of negative comments, which is just so...
Well, that's exactly it. He has to scream, you know, no, I'm not gay, I'm metrosexual.
It almost seems like it's a problem. Like, it for a heterosexual man, it's almost like he can't admit that, say, he would like a Lady Gaga song or a Madonna song because automatically his peers would just label him instantly.
Exactly. And I think one of the most disturbing things about all of this is the fact that people think they have a right to use an excuse to perpetuate an act of violence, period, against anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that should just be inexcusable public behavior, that you just don't walk up to someone and lay off and deck them, regardless of what you think the reason is.
Yeah. Yeah, that it gets into a cloudy, sort of murky waters around freedom of expression. Well, I'm sorry, any form of freedom of expression that includes elements of violence and hate should not be condoned. I don't know anybody on a general circumstance who would want to live in a society that allowed that to happen.
Exactly.
Exactly. And, yeah, we should, you know, quote Stuart Thompson's article in the Gazette there, because that's the article that we were talking about. Give credit where credit's due. Yeah. Yeah, so we're going to listen to a quick tape here, and it's bringing you back to more current. It's an interview this week with Marcel Marcellin, who's the diversity officer at the London Police Department, and he talks about some of the stuff that they've actually done. We had his promises, now let's see where they stand.
My name is Marcel Marcellin, and I'm the diversity officer with the London Police Service.
After the October 7th Rally for Peaceful Communities, the London Police Department has been working hard at eliminating homophobic violence within the city, correct?
Yes, we have. We basically looked into a program that's been running in Toronto for several years now. It's an awareness program called RHVP, Report Homophobic Violence, period. And we sort of borrowed the model from that program, and we're going to introduce it here. And we're looking at launching that on May 17th of this year to assist victims of homophobic violence in our city.
And that's going to be launched at the HBT Working Group's May 17th Day Against Homophobia, correct?
That's correct. That's correct, yeah. We're going to launch it at that event. We just think it's a timely event, and I think we want to sort of latch on to the momentum that's going to be carried forward in 2010 with respect to making sure that people are aware of some of the issues that are going on in our community.
Can you tell us a little bit about the RHVP program?
Sure. What it is, it's RHVP is a program that seeks to raise awareness of homophobic violence in any community. And it does so by targeting schools, young people, and educating them with regards to the effects of homophobic violence, the forms that violence takes, and making sure that people just understand that it's not acceptable in any community. So there are a series of pamphlets, brochures, and posters that basically raise the awareness and let people know that homophobic violence is not accepted in our community. And the other part of it is we want to make it easier for victims of violence to be able to report these crimes to police. We know that a lot of homophobic violent crimes and victims in the LGBT community don't report some of these instances to us, and so we don't have an accurate picture as to what is actually going on in the community. And we want to make it easier for victims of crime to report. And so we have sort of an anonymous procedure where victims can come forward and let us know what has happened to them and not necessarily have to provide detailed information about themselves, so that we can at least have an accurate picture of what's going on. And in turn, we'll be able to build some form of trust with members of the community so that eventually people will feel safe with going forward with prosecutions and charging individuals who are perpetrating these crimes.
Is it correct that this program has had a lot of success in Toronto?
Absolutely, yes. When they introduced the program in Toronto, I don't have all the accurate stats, but I know that the reporting of crime with respect to homophobic violence increased. And I think they now have a more accurate picture of the state of affairs with regards to assisting victims of crimes, and specifically in the LGBT community. So I think it's gone over really well in Toronto, and we want to replicate that success here in London.
With the RHVP program, the H stands for homophobia, but that just doesn't represent gays and lesbians, correct?
No, it includes everybody in the LGBT community. And so we're talking the transgender community, everybody that's covered under the umbrella of the LGBT community. But also we want to make sure that we're not just focusing only on specific victims, but all victims of crime. Because, you know, everybody in our community, we're all connected in some way. And so it doesn't matter whether you're a member of the LGBT community or not. We want any violence to be reported to us, and we don't want anybody to feel afraid or fearful of reprisals with regards to reporting crimes to us. So it's a overall community initiative.
As well as the RHVP program, the London Police have undertaken a lot of training around these issues as well, have they not?
Absolutely, we have. This year we've done a lot of training with regards to diversity and all dimensions of diversity. So we are in the process right now of completing a round of training for all of our officers, and they've received training in human rights, basic human rights, cultural competence. We've done some training with regards to hate crimes and LGBT awareness, and we've partnered with other community agencies to assist with delivering some of the programming and some of the training so that our officers are able to respond to the needs of the community more appropriately, being culturally competent and aware of some of the unique issues that our communities are facing.
Are you familiar at all with the Michael Gordon sentencing as it came down?
I heard a little bit about it. I don't have full details on it, but I did read a few emails with regards to the results of that case.
The police department has absolutely no control over the courts or the Crown when it comes to the sentencing in these cases, correct?
That's correct. Our job is, number one, we enforce the law and protect the public, and in doing that, we may lay a charge. And once that charge is laid, it goes into the criminal justice system, and the Crown attorney takes over and basically adjudicates it. And we our control from that point on is basically non-existent. We provide our evidence, and then the Crown attorney goes from there and presents that evidence in the courtroom. And so once it gets to that stage, we really don't have any control or input over what happens after that. So in relation to sentencing and things like that, that's something that the courts handle.
When decisions come down in these cases, like the Michael Gordon case, as the community are claiming weak, does that make your job as a police officer more difficult?
Well, I don't know that it makes our job more difficult. We try not to base our actions as police officers on, you know, whether sentences come out, you know, whether we're in favor of a sentence or not. Our job is really just to go out there every day and enforce the law. And sure, there are times that we're disappointed in a particular sentence or a particular result of a case. To be honest, of course, sometimes we are. But we try not to focus on that. We try to focus on our end of the job. And the criminal justice system, we all have to try to work together. And so as long as we do our end with diligence, that's all we can do. And then we have to leave the rest up to the courts. But sometimes it can be frustrating. But, as police officers, we're professional, and we just continue on and do the right thing.
Welcome back to Between the Margins here on CHRW 94.9 FM, and we are in here in studio with Eric Rosinski and Dan Pugh of the HPT Working Group. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, so back to the topic at hand.
Yeah, so Dan, just
yes, ma'am.
To introduce you to the audience, mm-hmm. You're chair of the HBT Working Group, another acronym, another committee. So you want to run us down what that is?
Yeah. So the London HBT Working Group stands for basically homophobia, biphobia, and transphobia. And this is a rather unique sort of community-wide collaborative that actually started about a year ago. And it was a small group of us who decided, we wanted to draw more attention to May 17th, which is the International Day Against Homophobia. How can we sort of pull on current resources and bring awareness and advocacy to the issue of homophobia within our community? There's a campaign that is based out of Montreal, a group there called Fondation Emergence, and their website is homophobiaday.org. And so you can order free resources through them, which is great, and that's what we've done for the past couple of years. We wanted to up the ante last year, and so we brought many people around the table. We organized a bit of a rally on May 17th, had a panel of speakers, you being one of them. And I think the response and feedback from that was overwhelming. I think we got more than we had essentially anticipated for being the first time. And it brought attention to the cause, and I think it also warranted us to continue doing this on a regular basis. So we've met every month as a group. There's over 25 members currently as part of the HBT Working Group. And the two main focuses at this point are to draw attention to May 17th, International Day Against Homophobia, and November 20th, which is Trans Remembrance Day. And so we're the ones behind the RHVP initiative. We're looking at creating some events for this coming May 17th. And so it's a fairly new group, and we have a Facebook page, and we're trying to work on a website here. We've got our logo up. We just issued a media release this morning in response to Eric's case and the media piece that hit the London Free Press on Friday.
Wonderful. So when we talk about, and Marcel in his interview, and mm-hmm. everybody that talks about this non-reporting issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty big thing. At Pride last year, there was the Pride survey.
Yeah.
And out of the people surveyed, 28% of them said they had experienced violence because mm-hmm. of their LGBT identity.
Right.
Which is pretty huge. Mm-hmm. That 28% of people experience violence. Yet only less than a quarter of those people reported that incident to police.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think that talks greatly about, about this problem that we have in our community. And Eric, you were talking about another person that had a great horrific.
Exactly. Yeah. Since my incident happened, and because it was so citywide known after the media got it and everything, people were approaching me and, sharing their own experiences and things like that as to what has possibly happened to them. And I mean, one girl was giving me credit, who was self-declared a lesbian, for standing up like that. And unfortunately, in that same night, she was attacked by two men who assumed that she was a gay male. and didn't realize that she was female until they ripped her shirt open and noticed she was wearing a bra.
That's terrible.
That's terrible. And these incidents, unfortunately, happen within the city of London all of the time. I mean, when you compare our incidents of hate violence to that reported in New York State, you know, London has almost double the hate crime violence of New York State, which tends to surprise people because we think our neighbors below the border have more issues with violence and and that. But when, you know, right here in London, Ontario, we have so many hate-motivated groups that propagate this kind of violence against all communities, and we've got to do things about that. And I think that's what the RHVP program is doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, when you see stats and figures and surveys about people responding to the level of gay bashing or hate-motivated violence in this city, you always have to sort of question, I mean, who's responding to that survey? If it's the greater mainstream public who identifies as heterosexual and doesn't experience homophobia on a day-to-day basis, it's not a very good snapshot of a reality, essentially. You know, the kids who do identify as LGBT in the classrooms and that type of thing, and they get bullied on a day-to-day basis, would have a very different response rate.
Yeah, and they've actually done that climate study.
Yeah.
For the school system, and the rates of homophobic violence that those kids are experiencing is extremely high. Mm-hmm. I know there's one study out there that the average student in a school hears a homophobic remark every 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty intolerable.
Well, I mean, it must certainly be enough of an issue that the school boards are starting to take notice now,
right,
and are starting to change the curriculum. But aside from that, it isn't just about homophobic violence. I mean, violence that has a homophobic base to it doesn't just affect people of the LGBT community. It affects people of all communities.
Mm-hmm.
Because if someone is going to perpetrate violence based on a simple fact of who one person is, what is to stop them from going after other marginalized groups? So it isn't just the people in the LGBT community, I imagine, that feel the fear. Everybody walks looking over their shoulder wondering, will I be targeted because I'm of an ethnic origin? Will I be targeted because I'm of a religious group?
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine that that's something that shakes us all up quite a deal.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I mean, a simple example of that could be, you know, my sister, who is a straight identified female, lives in Toronto. The minute she hears some kind of homophobic remark issued out on the street or in a club, I would imagine she's going to have an element of anxiety that goes through her. And that's, I mean, she's essentially still victim of that homophobia, even though she doesn't identify as you know, lesbian herself. It's in relation to me and my relationship, right? There's actually an interesting story that came out in today's paper, I believe, in the London Free Press. Yeah. And the title is One Man Takes on Homophobia for the Sake of His Son. And it's actually a story about Michael and David Pihak. Michael, I think that's how you pronounce his last name. He's a media personality in Toronto. And this story basically follows the fact that his father is an advocate around anti-homophobia and how he encounters that as an adult in certain sports venues. There's a story about hearing, you know, guys issue the word fag to a bunch of guys in a sports stadium, and how he sort of took this moment to stand up and respond to that, and how he was terrified inside because he's responding to a greater number of guys who are all riled up, but still, in that he's a straight man, he's a victim of that those homophobic remarks, and he's essentially standing up for his son and saying, you know what, it's not okay. And I think if you guys have kids, your fathers as well, how would you feel about somebody making those kind of remarks to you or your sons?
Yeah, and it starts early, right? I mean, all of these things, and where do these people learn it? I mean, we have Michael Gordon, who perpetrated this act of violence against Eric and his boyfriend,
right,
simply because they were holding hands as two men, you know? And Eric was sharing a story about in the courtroom with Michael's mother.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, I can't confirm it, But being ushered out of the courtroom, I'm pretty sure that some remarks were made in the same derogatory form as the original incident started.
By Michael Gordon's mother.
I would say yes, because at the time, we didn't realize it, nor did the victim witness assistance lady that was helping me realize it. But sitting me in the middle apparently was not a very good idea, because in comes Michael Gordon and family and sat directly behind me. And I should have thought otherwise, because I got chills up my back. And just referring back quickly to a minute about the story and stuff like that, and about how it would affect family, even though I may not be from here, it did affect my family back home. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, when this happened, not only do I feel that it may have insulted me and my partner at the time, but this also, I feel, was a slap in the face and a big insult to the gay community of London as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was what the rally was all about. I mean, what happens in a community when these events happen is the entire community is affected. I had people talking to me about, well, I'm afraid to go out of my house. I'm afraid to walk the streets. I'm afraid to go to the store. And I mean, I know I talked to you about it being directly involved, but the rest of the community was also sharing these feelings of fear.
Mm-hmm. The moment we lit some fire under the story, it brought people out of the woodwork. And I mean, it was a double-edged sword and things like that. I did have to put up with the heat of people thinking that I was just crying wolf or just wanting the spotlight and the attention. And that's not my intentions at all. I mean, my intentions was to make something that's a serious issue in the community of London and in the surrounding area brought up and known. And it worked. It did exactly what I wanted.
Exactly. Well, now we have the RHB program. It's going to be launched on May 17th mm-hmm. by the police department at our event, the mm-hmm. The HBT Working Group's Day Against Homophobia event. So people can look at that. But just to give you some really good background about that program, mm-hmm. We've got a clip. A gentleman from Toronto who runs that program came down to London and gave us a presentation. So we're going to listen to that now.
The London Police Service is proud to host this information session for Report Homophobic Violence period. As you're aware, the intent of this information session is to promote this public awareness campaign aimed at young people aged 13 to 25 to address reasons for homophobic attitudes and spur others to report harassment and violence to adults and police. The first 2 points of the London Police Service vision statement relate directly to our support of this campaign. Our success as a police service is dependent on these first two statements. That we provide optimum public safety and security to enhance the quality of life in the community. And we foster trusting, caring partnerships with the community in all its diversity. So we're committed to these statements, and our actions reinforce that we support the entire community. We encourage people to report all violence, intimidation, and harassment, but specifically tonight, we're reaching out to individuals who are victims of a hate crime based on sexual orientation. These crimes will not be tolerated in our community, and victims must be assured that they can report a crime and receive support from the London Police Service as well as an effective response. So thank you, and I hope you enjoy this presentation.
Now, this is not a police-driven program. It is a program that was designed by the community, in the community, for the community, under police guidance, if you will. Jake suffered 15 fractures to his cheekbone, a broken eye socket, a broken jaw, and a broken upper palate. We know that the person or the persons who inflicted those injuries upon Jake called him a dirty... So what do you expect your police service to do now? What was the reason for your rally? Come on, let's be frank here. Hate crime. You want a hate crime charge. However, there is a problem. So now, your hate crimes officer, he's going to crank out the Criminal Code of Canada, and he is going to look for the hate crimes section. He won't be finding it. We don't have a hate crimes statute, per se, in the Criminal Code of Canada. We can't say, we're going to go and charge for a hate crime. Why isn't there such a statute? Well, because the Criminal Code of Canada has a very neat, and actually most countries whose legislation is based on the Anglo-Saxon model, Anglo-Saxon legal tradition, they look at hate or bias motivation after the actual conviction for the offense. So it comes in at the sentence. So what police do is, we look at this and we say, well, we definitely have evidence for an assault. We have evidence for an assault causing bodily harm. We have evidence for assault with a weapon. This is what we're going to charge for. And we secure a conviction on those offenses. During our investigation, right from the very get-go, leading up all the way through the process, we are also gathering evidence as it pertains to the motivation behind this attack. It comes in at the sentencing stage. So we already have the conviction for the assault, and now we are recommending to the judge, when passing sentence, this is what you need to consider. This person attacked the victim here because of the actual or perceived membership to a certain identifiable group. And we know the list. Race, color, ethnic origin, nationality, sexual orientation, gender, gender identity, and so on. A judge in passing judgment or in passing a sentence shall consider the motivation. The judge shall consider either mitigating, which means facts that lessen the culpability of a person, or aggravating circumstances. Now, hate or bias motivation would definitely be an aggravated circumstance. And then a tougher sentence has to be imposed. You secure the conviction first, and then you bring in the motivation, so you already have the conviction. And then the motivation is the added bonus. And on top of it, what's really nice is that every conceivable offense in the Criminal Code of Canada, every listed offense, can be at sentencing stage declared a hate crime. Much like domestic violence, hate crimes have a tendency for the violence to escalate. So someone is getting away with name calling and is never being called on it. Then the slurs start. Then it goes to discrimination. And then it goes to assault. What is the impact of a hate crime? Well, obviously, you already know some of the impact. First of all, for the victim, it is so much more traumatic than any other kind of victimization. If I assaulted Helen, Helen is taking money out of the local ATM machine, and I'm going to hit her over the head and take her money. Helen is going to say, well, I'm really upset, I'm furious, my head hurts, and on top of it, I've lost my $100 that I've just taken out. But Helen's going to say, well, I was targeted because of what I have that the other person wanted. So there was monetary gain. That was the motivation behind it. Although it is a very traumatic experience, I can probably get over that. A lot easier than... Same thing happens, I'm gonna hit Helen over the head, I'm gonna call her a dirty d**k and every other name in the book, and then I'm gonna take her money. Helen has lost her money, she's got a headache, but on top of it, now she knows that she was targeted for who she is. At the very core of her existence, this is who I am. And there is nothing I can do about it. So it affects you at the core of your identity, at the core of your personality. So, so much more traumatic. You've experienced that with your two recent attacks here in London, that it did not affect only these two victims. It affected the entire community. Everyone got up in arms, and you had a rally. Because you as a community now are infuriated, you are hurt, and you are afraid. And you don't trust. So it also has a destabilizing factor in society at large. Other vulnerable communities also will be more alert. Because, I mean, if there are people out there who go and randomly bash LGBT folks, well, what is there to prevent these group of people to target members of the black community, of the Asian community, of the Jewish or Muslim community? So other groups are impacted as well. What is very, very frightening when it comes to hate crimes against the LGBTIQ2S community is that 56.3% of those crimes are violent crimes. They're the most violent ones, and they're all against the person. When it comes to hate crimes, in my opinion, the most shocking statistical evidence that we have is that hate crimes are a youth phenomenon. And that's frightening. If you think that Canada-wide, the 2006 report of Stats Canada, the Justice Statistics Profile Series, Hate Crime in Canada 2006, was published in 2008, over half of the victims of hate crimes are between the ages of 12 and 24. Canada-wide. And over two-thirds of all people accused of a commission of a hate crime in Canada are between the ages of 12 and 24. Our educational facilities, our schools, our colleges, our universities are the second most likely place for a hate crime to occur, offense location. What do you think, incidentally, the first one would be? Residences, homes. That's mostly mischief to property. This brings me to the attrition funnel, how hate crimes are being lost. So we have this huge pool, if you will, of hate-motivated criminal activity. A huge portion of it never gets reported to the police. If you don't tell us, we don't know about it, we can't do anything about it. An equally huge portion may not be appropriately recorded by officers. It can be a training issue. There may be someone on the road who hasn't had very much in terms of hate crimes training, and they attend a bar fight, and during the investigation, someone says, well, yeah, and they were calling this guy a f*** too. Okay. Well, that person may think, oh, well, or the officer may think, well, there was alcohol involved, and it's just a common swear word anyway, so there's no big deal about it. And that officer is not going to investigate this any further. And then it just gets written off as a bar fight. Well, in fact, it could have been hate-motivated. Another thing we are losing as a police service is we're putting in our reports, and yes, in our synopsis about what happened, we're going to put in, yes, this guy was called this woman was called a, but we're not actually checking a box in the report where we flag it and say this is hate motivated. The senior officer or the supervising officer, a sergeant or a staff sergeant, does not always have the time to read every single occurrence very, very carefully. So he's going to glance over it, and then that gets missed because it wasn't flagged as a potential hate crime. So it does not get referred to your hate crimes investigator. Once again, we lose. In the charging process, we can lose again because, well, it might just be easier to charge for something else. I mean, we can't charge for the hate crime anyway, but forget about that. So we lose there. And then probably the biggest loss for us is a process in the criminal justice system, which is called plea bargaining. In order to avoid going to trial, and so we're saving time and taxpayers' money, we're trying to avoid or reduce the number of trials that we have to conduct. So the Crown prosecutor is going to offer something to the defendant or the accused. What aspect of a crime do you think is most likely to disappear in the plea bargaining process? Hate motivation. It's going to go out. So we're losing huge here. And then, of course, that leaves us with a conviction rate for hate crimes, which is fairly minimal. Toronto Police has seen a 100% increase. We've doubled. We've had a 100% increase in reported hate crimes against the LGBT community, which, of course, caused a heart attack for the Police Services Board, until we explained to them that this is not indicative necessarily of an increase in violence, but it is indicative of an increase in the level of comfort of people to report to police. I don't want to make that statement that there was an article in Extra a couple of weeks ago, I think, that gay bashing may not be on the rise. I don't know that. But one thing I know for a fact is that reporting thereof has increased.
So, back to the matter at hand, Eric. The community is experiencing quite a bit of dissatisfaction with the verdict that came down. Tell us a little bit about that.
It seems like they just disregarded it. I mean, I found it to be another, once again, big insult. They marked it as a simple assault. They didn't feel that it was hate-motivated. The fact that Michael Gordon was currently intoxicated at the time and has no memory, as well as him having ADHD, and him having a 5-year long-term relationship with his girlfriend as well as a full-time job justifies him for not being punished as to what the Crown and I thought was to be marked with, not to be hit with the hate crime, hate-motivated assault charge, but that it only made it a simple assault because of those circumstances that the judge thought were valid reasons.
Even with the hate motivation set aside, that was a pretty weak sentence for somebody who unprovoked attacked somebody, drunk or not.
Yeah, and like I said, it's almost seems like it was an insult, not deliberate, but just almost like, I don't have time for this, get out of my court. Like, you know, just they didn't want to hear the victim impact statements. The Crown had to ask multiple times whether she would read it or I would read it. It was just file it, stamp it, get out of court. Like, he wanted more important things to do.
That's really sad.
It is very sad. And unfortunately, this particular judge has a history.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a history of letting people go and letting people get off lightly. I mean, this was the same justice and judge that ruled in the Elmer versus Children's Aid case where the parents in Elmer were using corporal punishment on their children using a stick, and the Children's Aid took the children away. And this was the judge that ruled on that case and said that he was used corporal punishment when he was a child, and
it was done out of love and in his best interest.
Yeah, so that, I mean, he has this tendency of bringing his personal opinions into his court decisions, and you know, and he's on record taking stabs at John Tory's campaign in the last election, where he was trying to get hard on crime, and him saying that, well, that's fine, but our prisons are overbooked, they're overcrowded, so where are you putting these people? And John Story's response to that was that him as a judge shouldn't worry about that side of things. He should persecute people and let the prison system figure out if
I'm
there's
just
room.
Wondering if I, hypothetically speaking, was his gay grandson, would he have done the same thing? Would it, he have felt differently? I ponder that. If it would have been somebody closer to home for him, how would he have felt then?
Well, and isn't that an unfortunate comment to make about society, in that the only way we're moved to respond to something like that the way we should is if we become personally affected by it.
Exactly.
And that's always the case, right? Because I know myself, you know, my wife and I, we meet people and they're like, oh, yeah, no, we don't mean you. We mean those other gay people.
Yeah. If I can just jump in very quickly, I just wanted to, before we close, on behalf of the HBT Working Group, we wanted to draft some kind of a media release to respond to the verdict and the sentencing case. And what we've done is basically come up with four very key points here, and one is that it is unfortunate that we didn't see something that was recognized by as a motivation of hate. Issuing negative comments like that is homophobic, oppressive, discriminatory harassment, and needs to be treated as such. It's interesting in that part of his sentencing, if it wasn't an act of hate, why is part of his sentence his probation to stay away from LGBT-identified locations? That's a bit of a contradiction. It's maybe would have been more helpful in part of his sentence to force him to, you know, volunteer with LGBT groups, so that way he has, you know, a deep sense of sensitivity training. I don't know that many of us would want to work alongside of him, but it would be a good lesson.
We asked
right?
for
around,
it. That's what we asked for.
Around sensitivity. Third, the intoxication piece. Not that it's necessarily an excuse, but I mean, you can't, someone can't be absolved of their behavior because they are intoxicated or because they can't remember as a result of that intoxication. That's just not.
If that was the case, everybody with a DUI would be walking the streets
exactly.
free and clear.
He was intoxicated, not remembering the case, but yet he remembers the accomplice that he was with. He was asking him for directions. So he can remember that, but can't remember nothing else.
Yeah, he can't remember pummeling a man with his fist.
No, not at all. Or kicking me in the head.
But he can remember directions.
Yeah. And I think the fourth that we were just wanting to comment on is that it's so important to report hate-motivated activity. And unless we're all capable of doing that and know or aware of the resources to do it and feel safe doing it, then we're not going to be able to advocate or respond on this in a community-wide forum. And so RHVP is in place to do that. The Hate Youth Crime Unit is in place to do that. The Hate Helpline, which is 519-951-1584 through LUSO's anti-hate, anti-bias programming, is there for community. And all of those pieces need to be advocated for and used.
And all of those resources will be up on our website, www.betweenthemargins.ca. And unfortunately, we're, as usual, we could do these shows in 2-3 hours, but we don't have the time. And okay, we do have more time.
Oh, yay.
The people have told us that we have more time.
2 minutes here.
Awesome. Excellent. So,
actually, before we divert off a topic, since we really didn't get to cover it, what was the actual sentence that was handed down?
He had simple assault. It was simple assault, 2 years probation, has to abstain from alcohol, cannot be in any placement that has alcohol, like facility, cannot be in any LGBT business establishment where it's primarily gays, lesbians, transgendered patronage. Obviously, he can't be in any contact in any way, shape, or form from me. Has to stay away from me. He's not allowed in my work, my home, or any place of education. He's had to pay $140 back, which was estimated from the store manager for the jacket because my face's blood was all over it. And a very generic letter of apology that I think my 3-year-old niece could have.
I think you
made
it earlier
a better one.
Kind of a Microsoft template.
it's a Microsoft Office template, you know, template.
I see you writing a heartfelt letter of apology. Can I assist you?
Yeah. And I mean, I don't feel that there was any genuine feelings behind it on behalf of the Gordon family, on behalf of Michael Gordon, or on behalf of the judge whatsoever. There was no genuine remorse, empathy, or feelings whatsoever.
And that's difficult when things like that happen. And you have to wonder if 911 hadn't been called, how far would they have actually gone with the attack? Would they have just stopped after beating you to the ground, or would they have irreparable damage?
Exactly. If my partner at the time hadn't have gotten his cell phone and called 911, if London police hadn't have been luckily in that area at the time, like, how much more damage would I have gotten? I mean, I reiterate, I was on the ground getting kicked in the head. It takes one good kick. I mean, you can do a lot of damage with one good swift kick. So I'm lucky compared to the other attacks, hate-motivated attacks that are happening in the world.
All it takes is one. I mean, yeah. We've seen that in enough hockey games.
Yeah, exactly.
Have any of us asked Michael Gordon to comment, or are we not allowed to do that, or is he not allowed to speak to
him? I'm not allowed to speak to him, just like he's not allowed to speak to me, so I know I definitely couldn't do something like that.
It would just be, I think it would be quite telling to pull, you know, a statement from him to see, you know, what he actually has to say or how he feels in response to.
So far, all statements are going through his defense counsel. He hasn't made any personal comment himself.
Right.
And he probably won't.
No.
It's not in his best interest, I don't think, do so, considering, well, let's see, he's just got a 2-year suspended sentence, and he's now on probation for 2 years, so at least there is, you know, some limited supervision for Michael Jordan. So that is the end of our show, and thank you very much to both of you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Everybody can check out our website, and for all of the information and archives from our previous shows,
it'll be at the end of the show. You've been listening to Between the Margins here on CHRW 94.9 FM. Special thanks to Ashley from F-Words, our acting producer today, as well as our guests, Eric Rosinski, Dan Pugh from the HBT Working Group, and Marcel Marcellin, the Diversity Officer of the London Police Department. To access our show archives or see a schedule of future shows, check out our website at www.betweenthemargins.ca or join us on our blog at btmlive.blogspot.com. You can also find us on Twitter under BTMLive. This has been Michelle Boyce and Gio Lakey. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CHRW 94.9 FM.